So, my name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. And I am a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found it necessary to take a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981. And for that, I'm grateful to God and a wonderful group and some wonderful men, some good women too, but for me, mostly men who helped me along this path. I'm going to talk a little bit about that, and I want to thank the group who had either the good sense or the bad judgment to invite me here. And I'm here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. So if I haven't at least pissed off at least 25% of the room by the time I'm done, I figure I haven't said anything. So, but if you're going to get mad at me for something, understand I'll probably, on the way home tonight, I'll probably say, why did I say that, and change my mind anyway. So there's no sense getting too upset. Last week we talked about step one, and I'm not going to go through a lot of that stuff about the drinking deal. We're done with that. We're done with that. You know, there's two rules in Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to drink in order to get here. Rule one. Rule two, once you get here, you're supposed to stop, you know. And if you can't figure that out, I can't help you with that, you know. But you will get helped with that, trust me. If you can't figure out that second thing, you'll get help. It'll just be a little more painful, that's all. But we're going to talk about other things. We're going to talk about the thing that's I most like to talk about, and that is emotional sobriety. You know, Bill Wilson said that's the next frontier in Alcoholics Anonymous, emotional sobriety. He said the real problem with Alcoholics is unhealthy dependencies, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that deal. And, of course, healthy dependencies. And there is really one healthy dependency that I've learned about in here, which will solve all your problems. Solve all your problems. You know, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. He will do for us. He will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. It's all over the big book. You know, we read it every day. You know, we don't. And you know, this is one. You know, we're so alcoholics are so defiant. That's our chief characteristic. We read this stuff. We hear this stuff. We're told this stuff. It's there in black and white. But you know, we don't want to hear it, so we just sort of change it. And then we steadfastly stand on our right to do it the way we want to do it. And you can't tell me what to do. You know, don't take my inventory and all that sort of stuff. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to. You know, I've been around for a little. It'll be 31 years in January if I make it. Sponsored thousands of guys and worked with many, many men in this deal. And so I have the benefit, a little bit of hindsight. I'm a recovering smart ass and know it all. So, you know, but I've gotten progressively dumber. I've gotten very stupid in my old age. And I must be, because all my sponsees tell me I don't understand. So apparently I don't get it, you know. But so what I'm going to do, and what I always try to do, is share my experience, because, you know, experience is very important. Hard to argue with experience. You see, what I've seen is I've seen the men that make it, very few. Maybe 0.5% to 1% make it more than 20 years. And of those, quite a few of them live lives of quiet desperation, just like most people out there. And a few men and a few women get what they're really selling in this book, and that is to experience much of heaven and be rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which they have not even dreamed. And that's really what I want to talk about. I have a heart for newcomers, but what I really have a heart for is guys with 15, 20 years who, you know, who know how to say the A, talk, and go home and suck their thumbs, and they're lonely. You know, I have a heart for people that are in the middle of this thing and they're doing their desert time and they're sober, because you know the interesting thing about alcoholics? They're pretty tough birds. You know, an alcoholic can come in here and grab onto the tools and decide to do this thing and use meetings sort of like they use the bar, you know, except you drink coffee instead of booze, and, you know, just make it from meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting, and read the books and do the bare minimum, do whatever you have to just so you don't drink, because an AA not drinking is a big deal, and it's good, it should be a big deal. And you'll get your medallions and everything like that, and you'll go to your deathbed never experiencing, you know, the pot of gold that's in this deal. You'll never experience the real deal. And so I want to talk about the real deal, what's really available, what's available to me, what's available to you, because I want anybody who ever comes in contact with me, as far as my sobriety, when I share it, to understand there's more than just not drinking. In AA, basically, I've seen it happen, because I've seen what the deal is here. I've seen who stays sober and who doesn't stay sober. You know, and they say in the big book, in Vision for You, every once in a while, a new guy comes in, or even a guy who's been around for a while, it says, don't miss it at all. Feel better, look better, having a better time of it. you know, that old thing, he says, we laugh at such folly. We laugh. I never understood that. Why would you laugh at somebody like that who says, I don't miss it at all. I feel better. Look, we know, this is what it says, we know he will drink again. He'll try the old, we know he will drink again. Can you imagine that? I mean, that's the weirdest thing in the world. I read that, I never understood it, you know, because that's why experience is such a good teacher. You know, my sponsor used to say, when a man with experience meets a man with money, man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with an experience. There's nothing like, you know, we all got opinions, we all got brains, we all got theories, we all got, well, this is what I think. But, you know, there's nothing like watching the people fall, watching the people die, watching the people not make it. All the wise guys, all the smart asses, all the people that think they know what the deal is, and watching the people who make it. There's nothing like experience. You know, why would they say that? Every once in a while, a kid says, comes in here and says, feel better, look better, having a better time, don't miss it at all. We laugh at him. We laugh at such Sally. We know he will try the old game again, because he is not happy with his sobriety. Soon he'll know loneliness as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. You know, imagine if you're in Alcoholics Anonymous and somebody comes up to you. Imagine you're here for about 30 years, just hanging out, watching things, sponsoring people, doing the deal. And somebody comes up to you and says this. Maybe you got a year sober, 2 years sober. Maybe you're sponsoring people and he says this. He says, cucumber. And 5 seconds after he uses the word cucumber, he drinks. And so you go and you sponsor somebody else, and they seem to be doing okay, and then all of a sudden they say the word cucumber. You know, they use the word cucumber in a sentence, and then 5 minutes later they go out and they drink. Let's say that happens to you over a period of 30 years about 1,000 times. Every time somebody says the word cucumber, they drink. You don't know why you have it. They just say cucumber and they drink. You just notice that pattern. The guys that don't say cucumber, they don't drink. The guys that say cucumber, drink. And then one day, you know, your sister, your cousin, or somebody you really care for comes up to you and says, you know, thank God I found AA. I really love this thing. You know, it's fantastic. And you say, hey, that's great. You know, anything I can do to help you? He says, yeah, there's only one thing. You know, cucumber. Think you'd be a little nervous? You'd be a little nervous, wouldn't you? You'd be a little worried. You might not even be able to explain it to them. I cannot tell you how many times in Alcoholics Anonymous I've had a guy come up to me and say, don't even worry about me. Drinking's out of the question. I'm not even thinking about drinking. I'm not even going to drink. Don't even worry about me. I got the drinking things. I got it down. I'm here to tell you, every time somebody's told me that, they've drank. Every time they've told me that. Now, when that happens to you about 100 times or 150 times or 200 times or 300, 400 times, they come up to you with that thing, don't worry, I'm not even thinking about drinking. I remember one guy, he had about 2 years. I sponsored him. He went to Montana with his wife and his kids, and he came back, and he hadn't gone to a meeting. He went to a dude ranch in Montana, and I called him up, and I said, Jack, what are you doing, buddy? And he says, let's go to a meeting. He says, nah, he says, I just got back. I'm getting things going. I said, hey, buddy, you've been gone for 2 weeks. You haven't been to a meeting. Just let's go to a meeting tonight. He says, Russell, stay off my back. He says, there's no problem. I'm okay. Listen, I'm not even thinking about drinking. Drinking's the farthest thing from my mind. That was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. By 4 o'clock, he was drunk. Blew 3 years. 2 or 3 years. Blew 3 years. You know what I found out in this thing? Very often, you don't realize that you're thinking about drinking until 5 seconds after you took the first drink. You know, there's a thing in this thing called the first step. It says you're powerless over alcohol. Being powerless over alcohol means powerless over alcohol. You say things like, I'm not even thinking about drinking. Drinking's not even a problem. Don't even worry me. I'm not going to drink anymore. You know what that tells me? You don't know anything about the first step. You think you still have some sort of control. You think that sincerity counts for anything. You think that strong feelings and emotionalism, you think that the stronger and harder you say it, the more you scream it, the more you yell it, I ain't going to drink again, and that's it. I lay the line in the sand. You think that that means something, and the bottle of scotch is just laughing its ass off. Just laughing its ass off. Because they know that you've learned nothing. you know nothing about it. You will try the old, soon you'll try the old game again. Now, you see that happen about 1,000 times, and then when you go to the big book and you read Vision for You, and it says, now and then a serious drinker being dry at the moment says, I don't miss it all, feel better, work better, have a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself inwardly. He'll give anything to have a half dozen drinks to get away with him. He will presently try the old game again. You know exactly what they're talking about. Very often, a lot of the stuff in the big book that you read, you don't read it or see it or understand it until 10, 20, 30 years down the road when you experience it. And then all of a sudden it becomes real to you. You say, whoa, I didn't even see that there. Yeah. And you know, if you're fortunate, if you're lucky, you know, maybe you get to that jumping off place where at least it gets you to a point where it so shakes you. That jump, it so shakes you that for at least a nanosecond or two, you pay attention. You know, we're supposed to be on the second step tonight, and, you know, I have a tendency to drift straight into the third step. As a matter of fact, I got to sort of warn you, you know. I have a tendency to do every step like that. Yeah, you know, some guy said to me, he said, you know something? Every time I listen to you, I think I'm hearing about the third step, and that's because I say, well, every time I talk, I'm always talking about the third step. Because it's all about the third step. That's what it's about. If you haven't figured out the third step, you got nothing. You got nothing in this deal. It's all about one thing. This program's always been around about one thing. It's only about one thing. It's only about one thing. And if you get that one thing, you will never have a problem again with anything. With anything. You know, that's what it says. It says in the big book right here. Right into action, I believe it is. Let me see whether I can find it. It says right here. And how it works. And this is going to be next week. We're going to talk a little bit about this. But this is what it says. It says, if I can find it. It says, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. He is the Father. We are His children. Most good ideas are simple. Not for alcoholics, though. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed the freedom. You know, they talk about a new freedom, a new happiness. You know, we've experienced much of heaven, been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. When we sincerely took such a position, what position? That position. All sorts of remarkable things followed. How many people would like remarkable things? You know, there are people in this room that they don't want remarkable things. They just don't want to drink. They just want to stay sober. They want to get back into the big bed. They want their job back. You know, they want their life back. Man, the last thing I want back is my life the way it was. You know, I don't want to be, you know, you got people in here, they just want to be normal. Man, God, can you imagine that? What if you hit it? What if you get that? I don't want to be normal. I want to be extraordinary. I want what these guys have. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things follows. We had a new employer being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. That says a few more things. So I have a tendency to slip into the third step, but we're going to really do that next week. I want to talk a little bit more about the second step and really my experience and how it worked for me. You know, I've thought a little bit about this. I have a tendency, you have to excuse me, it's just the way I am. You know, I don't have Alzheimer's. I think I have something called sometimers. You know, something that I just sort of fade. I used to have one of these minds where you had 50,000, you know, things going, and you're thinking about things all the time, and you can't stop thinking, and it's all about bad thoughts about yourself and other people, and now it's very hard for me to get even one thought going. There's such an inertia there, and very often I forget about what I'm talking about and things like that, but one of the things I tend to think about, and I tend to talk about, is what these steps mean to me now in my life at almost 31 years sobriety. What does the third step mean to me now in my life? And obviously, things have happened to me in the last 31 years that have changed. I'm not the same guy I was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 or 30 years ago. You know, when it says in the big book, you know, the A, B's, and C's, they read all the time, they say, we're alcoholics and we cannot manage our own lives. Has anybody ever read that?
Oh, yeah.
Listen, when I was 26 years old, I was married to a lovely gal. I might have shared this here. I'll share it again because there's a point to it. Wonderful, wonderful gal. Had a beautiful child, had a beautiful house on Miami Beach, on the golf course of Miami Beach. Had the world by the hoosets. You know, I was 100 pounds lighter. You know, and I had a great job, division chief for the state's attorney's office, and trying murder cases and all sorts of stuff like that. You know, for an egomaniac with inferiority complex like me, I was on top of the world. And my wife came up to me one Friday morning as I was going out in my blue pinstripe suit, white shirt, and red tie, and she looked at me and she said, "Russ, if you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." She didn't say it to start an argument. It was sort of like, "I just thought you ought to know," and then she walked away. "Come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." That's a pretty lean statement. There's no fat. There's no ounce of fat on that statement. "If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." You know, I mean, I think I spoke about this last week. I'll tell you something. If you have a problem with that statement, and let me tell you something. I'm not a dumb guy. I'm really not. I told my first sponsor I showed him all my diplomas, all my degrees on the wall. And that's the guy who didn't even graduate. He didn't even graduate high school. I showed him all my degrees, and he looks at me and says, "You know, Russ, rectal thermometer has degrees. You know what they do with those?" You know? I was unfortunately very badly undersponsored by people that didn't appreciate me. But I worshipped my brain. I'm like most alcoholics. I worshipped my brain. I worshipped my mind. I was going for departmental. I got departmental honors in mathematics. I was going for my PhD in algebraic topology. You know, I mean, unless you knew how to do the Schrodinger wave equation or the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, or wanted to talk to me about quantum mechanics, you know, I didn't want to. I didn't even hold you in any esteem. Those were the people I worshipped. Science is what I worshipped. The last thing I wanted to listen to was some used car salesman from Chicago. You know, tell me anything about life. Who's going to tell me anything about life? I know everything about anything. Nobody's smarter than me. And if you just disagree with me, that just means you're stupid. And so my wife looks at me on that beautiful day when I'm about ready to go to court, and she says, "If you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you." There's not a word you can take out of there. It's like it's so compact, you know? And I get in my car, and I drive to the first red light, and I stop, and this is what I say. "What the hell did she mean by that?" Now, let me tell you something. Let me tell you a little deal. It's not that I didn't understand the words. When you have problems understanding sentences like, "If you come home drunk more time, I'm leaving you," understanding that sentence, if you have an understanding of having that sentence sit in, and have it, you're going to, trust me, you're going to have a problem in your life somewhere down the road. That's like when the judge says to you, "I see you before me one more time, you're going away." You do this one more time. You hear these simple statements, and you just don't. And that's when I learned this little thing about alcoholics, that when an alcoholic sees, hears, or is told something he doesn't like, it confuses him. Now, let me repeat this, just in case there's people in here that didn't, you know, they were thinking about what they're going to do afterwards, what they did before, or, "I can't believe this guy's going to talk for the hour," or whatever the hell's going on in your alky brain this time. Let me repeat it, okay? When an alcoholic hears, is told something, sees something he doesn't like, makes him uncomfortable, it confuses him. Sometimes it just pisses him off, but the result is the same. It confuses him. He doesn't get it. It could be the only statement that will save his life. It could be the only statement that will save his marriage. It could be the only statement that is the key to his happiness for the rest of his life. If he doesn't like it and it pisses him off, it'll confuse him and he just won't get it. May not get it for 20 years or 30 years. May not get it till the day he dies. And it's not because the message hasn't been given him. It's because of something else. The message in this program is loud and clear. Yet 0.5% stay sober for more than 20 years. 1 in 200 stay sober for more than 20 years. And I sponsor a lot of guys that have 18, 19, 20 years that are not happy with their sobriety. You wouldn't know it because they know how to do the AA jargon. They know how to talk the AA stuff. But the truth is they're lonely. And they don't feel good about themselves. They don't feel good about other people. You can tell what's going on with yourself. Just all you have to do is look at who you're hanging out with and what you're saying and how you're talking. What are you talking about? You're talking bad crap about other people behind their back? You know, I was sitting there with my sponsor one day, and, you know, I was a bar drinker. You know what bar drinkers do? We sit in a bar, we talk shit about other people behind their back. I didn't even know that was wrong. It was just what I did. If I wasn't doing it, I would talk crap about somebody behind their back, and then I would shut up, and somebody else would talk bad stuff about other people behind their back. And the deal with that is you say something bad about someone behind their back, and you get someone to agree with you, that makes you feel better. And they say something bad about somebody, and they make you just talk bad crap about other people behind their back. Now, I didn't understand that when you feel crappy about yourself, and you hate yourself, and you don't like yourself, somehow, by talking bad stuff about other people and putting other people down, if you're somebody that hates yourself and has low self-esteem, by talking bad about other people and getting other people to eliciting them to agree with you, I didn't understand that that makes you feel better, sort of like scotch liquor. I didn't understand that. It was just something I did. You know, and that's part and parcel of the disease of alcoholism, just like drinking is. It's symptomatic of the disease of alcoholism. I didn't realize alcoholism goes on even after you stop drinking. That alcohol, the drinking of alcohol, was just a symptom of our disease. That our real disease centers in our mind and our body. That it has to do with the way we think, and that we just sort of produce toxic waste just by thinking. Men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others doing with impunity. But I'll tell you what, after you've been sober for a month or two or three or four or 18 months and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you got 1,000 voices in your mind and there's nobody to call and there's no AA room or no big book around or nobody talking to you and you're thinking, what's going to happen to me tomorrow and what's going to happen to me last week and why did that guy say this and why did she say that and what are they thinking about me and all that crap is going through your mind and you're worried about the money and you're worried about the this and that and then all of a sudden you just, and you're going nuts and you know it can't be scotch, it can't be bourbon because you haven't had a drink in 18 months and you figure out what the hell it is and then you find out what it is, it's alcoholism. It's alcoholism, and then you might even learn something. You might even say something like, now I know why I drank. I drank because no suit of clothes, no amount of money, no girl, no nothing ever worked quite as fast and quite as well as just a few drinks, and so that's why I drank it, because it got me to that place. And if it worked for me, I'd still drink it today, but it stopped working for me. You know, that's the sad news. And the sad news about my life is it stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me. And I stopped drinking alcohol when the consequences of my drinking came at me faster than my ability to lower my standards. It's amazing how low you can go and how many people you can hurt and how much of a worthless slug you can become and still tell yourself that you're okay and they're all crazy. It's amazing how much pain an alcohol can take and how much an alcohol can inflict and how much he can fall from the mark before he can look himself in the eye and say, who the hell am I kidding? But I'll tell you something, for me, and I believe this is true, getting to the point through the pain, through the humiliation, that's what it says in the 12 and 12, that's how we get a new perspective, through 1,000 forms of humiliation, the final crushing of our self-sufficiency. And that is really the problem, because as an alcoholic, I run from pain, I avoid pain, I lie to get away from pain, I'll cheat to get away from pain, I won't pick up the phone to get away from pain. I won't open up the envelope to get away from pain. I'll do anything. I'll throw you under the bus to get away from pain. And the problem is the only thing that will move you 90% of the time in this deal is pain. And so what do? You say, I got to get another sponsor. Why? Because my sponsor's an asshole. I don't like the way he talks to me. I got to get somebody who listens to me and treats me better. So what do as alcoholics? We run from the pain to the comfort. And it's the comfort. It's the comfort, because when you're comfortable, then you don't have to change. We run for the booze. Sometimes the booze looks like a woman. Sometimes the booze looks like, the booze comes in different colors. We run from, you know, very often here, when you as a going human entity have turned your entire life into crap based upon the way you're thinking, because I don't know about you, nobody ran my life but me. I was the CEO of my, I don't know if it was you running your life, you know, a week, 2 weeks, a year before you came in here. You know, every once in a while I'd listen to somebody, but the bottom line is, you know, I'm the one who made all the decisions. I just got to make sure whoever the son of a bitch was who was running my life before I came here never gets in charge again. I never want that guy running my life, because my best thinking on my best day got me into this place and hurt a lot of people. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll tell you something, if you hang around here and you stick with the winners, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that deal and how it plays into the second step, you stick with the winners, I can promise you, I can assure you, you are going to hear stuff. If you think don't drink and go to meetings is a bad statement or it bothers you, if you think some of the small stuff that we say about here about not drinking bothers you, You hang around with the guys who really got their act together in this deal, they're going to tell you stuff that's going to frost you. They're going to tell you stuff you're going to want to fire them. It's going to frost you. It's going to melt your eyes. You're going to say, who the hell is that guy? My sponsor. I'm sitting there at a table before a meeting like this, me and three other guys. I had about 3 months, wasn't doing anything wrong, you know, sitting in my AA group, you know, like my bar, and all of a sudden there was silence. You know, there was a little silence here before the meeting started. It was like silence. Silence bothered me. I didn't like silence. I always wanted a radio on or a TV on. Something going to distract me from my thoughts, because my thoughts were bad thoughts about me and other people. So if I'm sitting at a table with three or four guys and there's silence and nobody's talking, what do you think happens? I start talking. What do you think I talk about? I talk about Bob. That's what I'm used to talking about. I'm used to sitting in a bar, looking at some guy at the other end of the bar that I don't know with a cute blonde and saying, look at that asshole. You know, I can spot them just like that. They drive nicer cars than me. They got prettier women than me. You know what I mean? They look like they got their crap together. You know, all those jerks out there. You know, and so I'm sitting there and there's a silence in the room. And so I start talking about Bob, who's not there. And I say something like, boy, somebody ought to do something about Bob. You know, that guy's got a lot of problems. Bob, I'm not looking to hurt anybody. I'm just talking. My mouth is just going, because that's what alcoholics do. I decide I just want to talk about something. And my sponsor looks at me and he says, Russell, he says, let me tell you something. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, in this fellowship, we don't talk badly about other people behind their back. We don't gossip and talk badly about other people behind their back. So he says, so unless you have something good to say about somebody, why don't you just shut up? He said that to me in front of other guys. He humiliated me. You know, what do you think I did as an alcoholic, you know? I mean, I pictured burning down his house, raping his wife, killing his dog, reporting him to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think you're allowed to do that. Love and tolerance is our code. You know, I think, you know, he hurt my feelings. He's not allowed to do that. Doesn't he know I'm sensitive? I told him once I was sensitive. He said, you're not sensitive. He said, great artists are sensitive. You're just touchy. He told me to shut up. He said, if you don't have anything good to talk about anybody in AA, why don't you just shut up? And you know what happened? What happened was this. He said, and I would have fired him, and I would have run away, but I had one thing going for me. Above everything else, I didn't want to drink. And somehow I connected not drinking with knowing this man, Bob Sullivan. And I, more than anything else, no matter how much it was painful, no matter how much he humiliated me, I somehow knew that if I walked away from this guy, I might drink. You know why? Because I wasn't one of those guys that said, I don't even have to worry about drinking. I was worried about drinking. I didn't trust myself. You know why? Because I was powerless over alcohol. I didn't even know why I was sober. It was amazing to me that I was sober. I knew it had something to do with these rooms, something to do with him, something to do with prayer, something to do with reading that 24-hour book, something to do with doing the things he'd said, and I didn't want to take a chance of having it on my own because I was not cocky. I did not feel like I had this thing by the hooses. I didn't know. I was scared. And so you know what? I did what most alcoholics do, because we're all love-me-aholics too. We don't want to be rejected. We'll do anything. We'll prostitute ourselves. Do anything. Tell me what you want me to say or how you want me to be so that you'll like me. That's why in a country and western bar, I drink beer. In New York, I drink Manhattans. You know what I mean? In Key West, I drink margaritas. I never get them mixed up. I never go into a country and western bar and say, give me a margarita. You know what I mean? I'm always looking what other people are doing because I want to blend and I want to fit in. And if I'm at a dope party and they're smoking dope, I'm smoking dope. I'm doing, and if they're cursing, I'm cursing. And if they're all atheists, I'm an atheist. And if, you know, whatever, I am whatever I got to be so that you'll like me. That's why when I get out of treatment or wherever I am, the first thing I say is, what do I say if somebody says, do you want a drink? Give me a cover story, because I can't just say no, because they may not like me. And if you don't give me a cover story so that they like me anyway, even though I say no, I might have to drink and kill myself, because I'd rather drink and die than risk the fact that this son of a bitch that doesn't even pay my visa bill may not like me. Because my self-esteem is so low. Because, you know, alcoholics say things like, what? I don't give a shit what he thinks about me. But you know that anybody who says things like, I don't give a damn what they think about me, all they do is think about what other people think about them. Because people who really don't care what other people think about them don't say, I don't give a damn what they think about me. They say things like, pass the salt, let's get a pizza or something. They don't say that. You know? So you're dealing with a person who's sober, is always thinking about, what is he thinking about me, comparing his insides to somebody's outsides, is selfish, self-centered in the extreme. That's the real nature of the disease. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the nature of this disease. Driven by a thousand forms of fear, self-delusion, you know, self-centeredness. We step on the toes of others today and retaliate. So you can get rid of the booze, but how do you get rid of the crappy feelings? How do you get rid of thinking about, what did I do yesterday? What am I going to do tomorrow? How is this going to hurt me? What's he going to do? What's he going to say? Did they like me? Didn't they like me? Are they going to like? How do you get rid of the questions and the unknown? How do you get rid of the feelings? How do you get rid of the always, always, always thinking about yourself and thinking about what you need or what you got to get or what you got to grab or what you have to have in your life or what you're going to lose in order to make yourself better because you're just not okay the way you are? How are you going to get rid of that stuff sober when you can't stop thinking about it and all you do is try to control your life, and they say you're alcoholic and you can't manage your life, and all you do is spend the entire day trying to figure out how to manage your life and control other people and control other people's thoughts, because if they don't think the way you do and agree with you and do things the way you want, something's going to happen. I don't know what it is, but it's going to be bad. How do you do that stuff when it says no human power can relieve your alcoholism, when all you're doing is looking for some gal or looking for some guy or a husband, wife, or something that's going to make you okay? I was always looking for her, the one that was going to make me okay, and she ain't out there. It ain't never going to happen. And you got some book that says God could and would if he were sought. God could and would, being convinced. We are now at step 3. But you want to know something? I know that's a simple statement. It says a simple thought, a simple statement. But, you know, that's about as simple as saying you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I don't like it. So it confuses me. So I think I understand AA, but I don't understand AA at all. But here's the deal. Here's what happened with me. What happened with me was this. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't tell you why this happened or how it happened. And I noticed, I don't know if you ever noticed this line. You guys who have gone to AA meetings a lot, you notice they have this line that they read at every meeting. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. You ever hear them say that line? You ever think about that line? Listen. You see, you guys think you're ready to take steps. See, some guys, you go to treatment centers and they force you to do the steps, right? They say, you're not going to get out of here until you do step 4. You're not going to get out of here until you do step 5. They force you to the steps almost like they're tools, like they're psychological tools. You see, I can talk a lot about my experience. I can talk a lot about what has happened to me in the last 31 years. I can talk, but you know what this one thing I can't give you? The one thing I can't give you is I can't give you the desire. I can't give you the want to. I can't give you the want to be sober and have what he has more than sex, more than the wife, more than the boss, I can't give you that deal. There are going to be guys that come in here and they will do anything to have what that guy has because they want it so badly. And they'll risk losing the job, and they'll risk losing the growl, and they'll risk losing the broad, and they'll risk losing the money, and they'll risk losing this because they want that deal so much, and they will listen. They will get humiliated. And they will get hurt, and their feelings will get hurt, and they'll come back for more. And there are guys that'll do that because they want it so bad. And there are other guys that, you know, won't even see what's going on with the other people. They don't have a we. They don't want what that guy has because they don't see anything in here that they want. They just want what they had before. And they're operating on their own speed. And they may do the steps, may do this stuff, or kind of semi doing it. But you want something? It's not because they want anything that's going on in here. And you know what it says? If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain. You're not even ready to take the steps until you want what we have and are willing. And there are some people that they want what we have. They see something they want, but they're just not willing to go to any length to get it. And any length ain't climbing the Himalaya mountain. You know what any length is for an alcoholic? Turning off your flipping cell phone during a meeting. You know what that's like for an alcoholic to turn off a cell phone during a meeting and not text during a meeting? That's like climbing Mount Everest because they're so important and everything out there is so important, you know, the stuff that's going to kill them, that they got to constantly be plugged in because they would rather have their minds out there than turn off and risk missing a text message to a girl or a guy, something like that. You know, that's any lengths for an alcoholic. And some people, you know, they don't want what we have. They don't even know what they have or why, what we have is important. They just want the money and they want the stuff back and they're not ready. They're going to fall by the wayside too. And so I came in here at the Alcoholics Anonymous, and I saw something. I saw the guys. I saw the deal. I thought everybody saw what I saw. I was wrong. I couldn't believe it. You know, we would follow guys around. We would follow, you know, I was talking today. I don't know how many of you guys are into sports. Now, I'm not. You can look at me and tell I'm not into sports. But I have a lot of friends that are into sports, and I've watched sports on TV and all that sort of stuff. And you know how when, you know, I had one guy, I don't even know what he's here now. He's into what do they call it, cross training. Anybody know what cross training is? It's some sort of physical thing. So we were talking the other day, and he's doing, I was talking about this cross training thing. This running, triathlon, and all sort of stuff. And I said, you have guys that are, there's a lot of people that are involved in this kind of stuff where they work out, intense workouts. And I said, you have guys in cross training that sort of like, I mean, they're sort of like Olympic cross trainers, you know what I mean? They're like the Tiger Woods of cross training. These are guys that are at a, they're doing the same thing you're doing. They're doing the same thing that everybody else is doing, but they are like at a level. They're at a spot that, you know, they're doing the same thing, but their deal is so far advanced. They're into something. It's a different deal. You understand what I'm saying? It's like, you know, there's golf. I play golf. I don't know how many people here have played golf. And there's millions of people that play golf, and then there's Tiger Woods. And you know he's using the same clubs, you know what I mean? And he's hitting the same ball, and he's on the same course, but somehow you know he's at a level, he's at a place that you have never even imagined. He's playing a game, you only think you're playing golf. He's not even playing golf. He's playing some sort of spiritual deal that's up there that you will never, ever experience. And there's only a very few of them, and they make a lot of money. And he eats, breathes, and sleeps this deal in his sleep. And he's so focused on this thing, it's more important than anything. This cross trainer, I said, what do you call these guys that are like that? He says, we call them fire eaters. I was once involved in a discipline where we had guys like that doing certain things, and we used to call them road warriors. They had names for them. It was something like a cut above. And every sport has these guys. And every discipline has these guys. There's these guys, you know what I mean? And then there's the rest. And somehow, if you're an alcoholic, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would notice these guys. And they would become, I remember one time I had about a month sober, and I went to a meeting, a month or two sober, and I talked about Al Kennedy. My sponsor was one of these guys. And you know, these guys, once you link up with one of these guys, they always seem to hang around with the other guys. You know? And I know they introduce you to another guy, because the guys they hang out with are these guys. They don't hang out, they don't suffer fools. They're not talking bad shit about other people behind their back. They're not thumb-sucking crybabies. They're not complaining. You know, they're not doing that deal. It's these guys. And there's very few of them. My sponsor used to say, many are called, but few are chosen. You can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? And you know it when you see it. And it's like pornography. I can't define it, but you know it when you see it. You know it when you're dealing with one of these guys. You know you're an alcoholic. You know they're an alcoholic. You know you're working a program of recovery. You know they're working a program. But whatever they're working is different than your deal. It's a different deal that's going on. And I went to this meeting. There was this guy named Al Kennedy, and he was talking. And man, I'll tell you, it was like I was watching him. It was like watching a symphony. I mean, this guy was so comfortable in his skin, and you just knew it. You know, he wasn't talking about, he was talking about the steps, but he wasn't talking about the steps. It was like effortless for him. He was living life and being in an effortless way. There wasn't any anxiety. There wasn't any effort. There wasn't any pretense. There wasn't any phoniness. He was totally transparent. He was comfortable in his own skin. He was lifting people up. He was the kind of guy, just by talking, you somehow felt that you were with somebody that, man, if you could hang out with this guy, that you would be okay if you could just be with him. If you could just hang out with him, you would be okay, because he was that steady. And then he walked out of the room, and there was just something about him. And it wasn't like he would say, I'm doing step four, I'm doing step three. He wasn't doing it. He was like living it. He was step three. He was step four. He was step ten. He was all the steps. It was in his mannerism. It was in his voice. It was the way he talked. It was the way he was acting. It was all about this stuff, but without even looking like he was doing it. He was like riding that bike without holding on to handlebars. And I turned to my sponsor. I said, man, that guy was great. And you know what my sponsor told me? He said, you know, he's dying of cancer. He's dying of cancer. Can you imagine that? You go to a meeting, you hear some guy talk, walks out the room, and he says, you know, he's only got a month to live. And I looked at him and I said, well, he didn't say anything about that. He says, I know. Do you know what it's like when you're a thumb-sucking crybaby and all you want to do is talk about your problems and talk about how bad things are and talk about... You ever been to discussion meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous? me, poor me. My mother, my father, you wouldn't believe my boss. You wouldn't believe what happened to me today. You wouldn't believe the car. You wouldn't believe my wife. You wouldn't believe the money. I can't believe what has happened. When am I going to feel better? Just one big, the view, you know, one big sob session. One big thumb-sucking crybaby. I'm not putting it down, but that's the deal, right? Everyone can't wait to say, well, let me tell you what happened to me. Well, let me tell you what happened. And every once in a while, you get some guy that says, every once in a while, something good pops up. Somebody says something. It's helpful. And then everybody closes out the session, and you feel good for about 5 minutes until you get in your car. And then half an hour later, you're nuts again. And you can't wait to get to your next meeting for the fix. It's like a Xanax. People using meetings like a, you know, my Xanax, you know? And you think you're doing a program of recovery, and you've never noticed after you got 20 years that you've been basically treading water and like walking in space. You haven't gotten anywhere. All you're doing is you substitute meetings for booze. Because the bottom line is you're still going nuts. And every once in a while, you run into these guys, and they're just at a different place. And you think it's because they have any problems, and you find out they're dying of cancer, they got no money, the wife has left, and you want something, it's not even touching them. And you can't even understand, and you know you're an alcoholic, and you know he's an alcoholic, and you know you're working a program, you know he's working a program, you know he's an AA, and you know you're an AA, and you can't figure out what's going on. It's because he's at a level, he's playing golf at a whole different level. There's a whole different deal going on there. Because he's experiencing much of heaven. He's been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. And he's experienced that new freedom and that new happiness. And all that stuff has happened to him. And God has done for him what he can't do for himself. You know, and it's a whole different story for him. And he could be dying and have a month left. And 2 months later, Al Kennedy was dead. And I was amazed. And I wanted what he had so badly. And I didn't even know what he had or how to do it. Because I couldn't even envision. I couldn't wrap my mind around a guy doing that stuff. And I ran into those guys, and I wanted to be with those guys. Other guys were in the parking lot smoking dope. Other guys were in the parking lot smoking and joking and looking for gals and going to the dances and everything. And I wanted to know, where was Al Kennedy speaking? Where was Joe Snyder's meeting? Where was Eddie Edwardson? We would go up and see these step meetings. You guys don't know how lucky you are. You're in South Florida. You know, I didn't realize this. I grew up down here, MAA down here. I didn't realize, because I'd go to step series. Like, this is a step series. I'm going to be here for 12 weeks. And they take guys that have 20, 30 years, and they put them up here, and for, you know, 12 weeks, they talk about not drinking or stuff like that. Not that it's not important, but they talk about other, they dig deeper. They talk about other stuff. They talk about living life sober. And I would run, we would run to hang out with these guys and have dinner with them beforehand and have coffee with them afterwards and listen to them at the meeting. So we just grab a little of this stuff, maybe get it by osmosis. You know, I didn't realize until I left for places like New Jersey and other places, they don't do any of that anywhere else in the United States. Did you know that? Now, I haven't been to everywhere in the United States, but I've been to a lot of places. You know, the only thing they got discussion meetings where people talk, and you know how that's what that's all about. You know what that deal's about. You know, let's talk about relationships. Yeah, let me tell you about my girlfriend, my boyfriend. You know, it's not about, you know, they, and they got speakers meetings. And you know what those are about. Nothing wrong with that. It's supposed to be, and then I drank. And now I don't drink anymore. Which is good, but it's like a spiritual kindergarten. But if you want to dig deeper and you want the deeper stuff, the great thing about AA in South Florida is you got to hang out with these guys like an Al Kennedy, like a Bob Sullivan, like a Joe Snyder, like a Ray O'Keefe, and hang with them and be with them every week and sort of see the way they think and see what they were talking about and how they were and how they acted. And it brought you to a different level of golf where you could watch this thing. And even though you didn't understand it, it didn't make any sense in some strange way, you didn't see how you could do it, you knew, you see, I'll tell you something. I have a relationship with God, and I believe in God today. I didn't believe in Him much before, anything like that. But the bottom line is, even though I say that, I need to see it physically. I need to see His physical presence and manifestation in other people's lives. I need to see the weight loss. I need to walk up to the guy and say, how did you get that? Well, how did that happen to you? And I'm going to close this up by saying this, you know, about 3 years ago. And you know something? When you want what they have, and you're willing to go to any length to get it, and you have that we, and you hang out with these men, okay, and you just hang out with them, and you listen to them, and you open up your mind because you want what they have so badly, all the other stuff comes in. Because I've never met one of these guys where it isn't all about God. And I've never met one of these guys. I've never met one of these guys, you know, who has what I want, where they're not talking about the men. Now, we don't put people up on pedestals here, but the bottom line is, every one of these guys, even Bill Wilson, followed Ed Dowling and Sam Schutzmaker, where there wasn't somebody that went before them that they looked up to, and they said, I want what that guy has. I'm excited about it. I want that deal. You know what I mean? And they were following that. They were following some man or following some woman, and they wanted what they had. God help me if I ever get to the point where I said, I got it now. I'm on my own. Thanks, buddy. I'll take it from here. I'm going to give you one last story. Try to close it down in around 2 minutes if I can. God forbid I should go over. That was me in the bar. Oh, I'm 2 minutes over. I got to get home. Yeah, we only stop watching the clock after we get sober. You know, in the bar, the wife can wait for three hours, right? Once you get sober, go, hey, I think this guy's going to go over 9:30, you know? You know, I might get sober or something, you know? So I'll tell you a little story. This is a true story. About five years ago, I was listening to this guy in a completely other venue. It was a Bible study, and he told this story. It's a true story. I looked it up. I read all about it. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was a great story because it really, really was analogous to what happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. In Bannerman, there's a place called Bannerman, Montana, and there was a huge gold strike and silver strike in 1853. And this was after Sutter's Mill, the California gold strike. It was a little bit smaller than that, but it was still huge. And it was outside of the Black Hills, which was Crow territory, and white men were not allowed to go into the Crow territory because it was the Indians, but that's where all the gold was. So in 1853, about 300 or 400 miners went into Crow territory to look for gold because, you know, the Crows had what they wanted. You know, they were willing to go to any length to get it. And they went up there. They didn't really find much. But there were seven guys, you know, and I forgot all their names. One of the guys' name was Bill Fairweather, who was lagging behind. They went a day after the main group left, they left, looking to get gold in the Black Hills. After they were out there for about 2 or 3 days, they got captured by the Indians. This is a true story. You can look this thing up. It's called look for Alders Creek Grasshopper Gulch, Banner, Montana. And they ran into these Indians. They got captured. They escaped, except one guy. And they were on their way back to Bannon, and they stopped at this gulch, this canyon. I think it was ended up being called Grasshopper Gulch, you know, or Alden's Gulch or something like that, because one of the guys' name was Alden. And while they went to look for firewood and things like that, one of the guys was tapping on some rim rock, and he found $200 worth of gold. Now, back then, $200 worth of gold is like what today would be like $3,000 worth of gold. You understand? So imagine you go out on the street and you find $3,000 on the street. So they come back and they're tapping on this thing, and they accumulate like $3,000-$4,000 worth of gold, just rummaging through the area, working it for about two. So they realize they've hit something really huge. So now they got to shut up because there were claim jumpers there. And they make a decision. They're going to go into Banner. They need to get supplies, and they're going to go out and they're going to start working the mine. You know, they're going to be multi-gazillionaires. And here's the deal: they took a solemn oath. You know, the solemn oath was nobody says anything to anybody. You understand that? You know, there used to be a mobster down here in Tampa called Santos Traficante. He says the only way to keep and one of the statements he made is the only way to keep a secret among three people is two have to be dead. Well, I don't know about that, but in any event, the bottom line is that they went into Bannon, Montana, and they were going to all meet at the old oak tree, and then when they gathered up their supplies, they were real fast, and they start walking out, and as they're walking out, all six of them, to the old oak tree, what do you think they saw behind them? About 200-300 miners following them. So they knew somebody had spilled the beans. Somebody had talked, and they didn't know who, because all the guys were saying, I didn't talk. So when they met up with the leader of the 200 people that were following them, you know, Bill Fairweather said to him, he says, "Who? How'd you learn it? Who said? Who talked?" He said, "Nobody." He says, "Nobody." Then he said, "How'd you know?" He says, "We could see it in your eyes. We could see it in your eyes." He says, "We knew you had hit the mother lode. We knew you had hit the mother lode." And I've been hanging around with the miners in this deal ever since. Listen, the man or woman you're going to be 5 years, you know, I could sit here and try to talk for 16 hours. I won't. Don't worry. It's not going to happen with all the A's, B's, and C's and what I did in my entire experience. It may mean something. It may mean nothing. You may get something. Whatever it is, it's, you know, when the pupil's ready, the teacher appears. You're going to get what you're going to get. But the bottom line is this. You know, we all think we're brilliant. We all think we're smart. We all think if we read this thing in 5 minutes, we read it twice and underline and everything like that. And I say, know the big book. It's very important that somehow we're going to get this thing faster. Let me tell you something. You know what I learned? I wanted 20 years in 20 minutes. I wanted what they had immediately. You know something? You know how long it takes to get 20 years sobriety? About 20 years. You know, that's how long you got to be in the oven. And here's the bottom line. The man or woman you're going to be and what's going to happen to you, they were right about, you know, if you want what we have, you're willing, is going to depend upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. And the books you read and what you talk about and what you think about and the conversation that's going on in your mind is going to depend 99 to 100% with who you hang out with. So you want to find out what's going on in your life, you find out who you're hanging out with, who you're listening to, who you're talking to, who you're sitting down next to at coffee and who you're asking questions about, who's talking to you. And if it's nobody, that means you're talking to you. And that's a bad deal. You don't ever want to be learning from yourself. You know, I've got a sponsor, he's got 57 years. I got other guys in my life that they're 30 years older than me. I've gone everywhere, to Bible studies, wherever I've got to do to find those men farther down the road for me, those Al Kennedys, so I can learn from them and listen to them. You ask yourself this question, who am I hanging with? Who am I listening to? Who am I talking to? What is the conversation about? That'll tell you exactly where you're going or where you're going to be. You know, whether you're going to be one of these grown-ups in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be walking the narrow road, or you're going to be one of these thumb-sucking crybabies who are going to end up drinking again. You know, you follow the minors. It'll all come into play. You know, and you know, and somehow, some way, by following these guys, and hang, listen, you know as alcoholics better than anybody else, if you follow the wrong guy, or the wrong gal, or the wrong group, you know exactly where you wind up. You wind up in places where you can't even believe. You're sitting there saying, how the hell did I get in this jail cell? How the hell did I get here? I don't even know how I got my, how the hell did I get myself in this jam? And you know you were involved in it. And when you look back, you say, well, it has something to do with who I was hanging around and who I was listening to and the crap I was listening to. Well, you want to know something? It works the same way, the opposite way. 20 years down the road, when you got a wife of 30 years and 4 children and 6 grandchildren, self-supporting through your own contributions, you love God, and you feel good about yourself, and you say, how the hell did I get here? How the hell did I get here? How did I get here? A screw-up like me, an idiot like me, a nutcase like me. How did I get? Well, it must have something to do with the people I was hanging out with and the people I was listening to. God bless you. Thank you very much. Wow.